thanks for the organizers. Thank you all for showing up on such a beautiful evening. So you have to spend it indoors speaking about wars and destruction. As Paul mentioned, I've been working with the American Friends Service Committee for a while. I started working with the AFSC when I was still in Iraq in 2003 and 2004. I had some periods where I was on AFSC's payroll. Sometimes I'm just a volunteer. So now I'm back as an employee of the American Friends Service Committee in Washington, D.C. I am half Iraqi and half Palestinian. My father is a Palestinian from Jenin, and my mother is an Iraqi from Baghdad. And I grew up mostly in the Middle East, between Iraq and Jordan and Saudi Arabia, and immigrated to the United States in 2005 and became a U.S. citizen a few years after that. So tonight I would be speaking about huge topics. Each of them needs weeks to discuss. So I thought I'll keep my comments very brief and open it up to get more of your feedback and discussions, and I will try to weigh in on the points that you would raise. So let me start by speaking about what has been keeping many of us up at night, the situation in Palestine, the recent escalation and the attack on Gaza. I was in Jerusalem a few weeks ago, just a couple of weeks ago. And although I am half Palestinian, as I mentioned, I have never had the chance to visit Palestine or Israel before in my entire life. Because my father and my grandfather, they left before 1967. Ran away to Jordan. And this is a story of millions of Palestinians around the world who left their home country in 48 or 67 or in other dates in the past. There were massive movements and migrations and ethnic cleansing and displacements that happened in Palestine. So my family is recognized as an internally displaced family because they first moved from Haifa to Jenin in 1948. So we have cards from the UNRWA proving that we are IDPs, internally displaced. And then we have other cards viewing that we are refugees. Because they moved from Jenin to Jordan. And I think my family had another three or four displacements after that. They had to leave Jordan to Lebanon, and they had to leave Lebanon to Iraq. And we had to run away from Iraq yet another time after 2003, while bombs are falling on our neighborhoods. So it's a long family tradition to be displaced. And I think it was only from my Palestinian side, but unfortunately now I have Palestinian and Iraqi family all around the world. People who used to live within an hour away driving from each other are now from the west coast of Canada to New Zealand. I have family members on every continent. I mean, it just shows you the effects of war. So my trip to Jerusalem, let me start speaking about this, and then I will touch a little bit on what's been going on in Iraq and Syria and open it up for your questions. Like many of you, I've been interested in the Israeli-Palestinian conflict, or at least this is what we call it in the U.S., and the U.S. role in what's been going there, I have extra interest because of my family lineage. And I thought that I had a grasp on the situation and dynamics in Palestine and in Israel until I landed in Tel Aviv. I think driving from Tel Aviv to Jerusalem, which is a 40-minute drive for me, an American citizen, and a four-hour drive for a Palestinian, that 40-minute drive taught me more about the Israeli occupation and the realities of Palestinians than reading for decades about it. Because it's in your face. That's one of these conflicts that is in your face. The width of Israel and Palestine next to where Tel Aviv is. So from the sea to Jordan is smaller than Baghdad. The width of the West Bank and Israel. It's so tiny. Everything is so small. So the systems of oppression are not really spread around. They're like really there to see them. You know, like I drove on a street that was an Israelis only street. Palestinians were not allowed to drive on that street. Palestinians were prevented from walking on that street by two huge walls on each side of the street. And I could see Palestinians driving on their roads, roads that were less fancy, interrupted by checkpoints, and I could see them, but the two infrastructures are completely separate. You can't actually take a right turn and go from the Israeli street to the Palestinian street. So two different universes, two different class of citizens who don't collide. Palestinians go under the Israeli street in a tunnel. And for someone like me who's never seen that, I mean, it was really shocking. It was very shocking. Going through a couple of the checkpoints and seeing the American privilege that I have, I can go to the old city or go walk around East Jerusalem or cross any checkpoint at any time that I want. But people who their families have been living there for thousands of years can't. And so it was a very educational experience for me. And I highly encourage any of you who if you ever have an opportunity to travel to Israel and Palestine, to do it, even if it was for a week. I know of many organizations who organize trips to Israel and Palestine. AFSC is involved with some. I'm sure many organizations here are involved in some. In East Jerusalem, I stayed a few blocks away from where the Palestinian teenager who was abducted and burned alive used to live. So it was just a few minutes away from where I stayed. And that was around the time that it happened. As you all know, this recent escalation happened because Israel claimed that three Israeli settlers were abducted, and they blamed Palestinian factions and Hamas in particular of being behind the attack. There was unprecedented language used inside Israel that was very inflammatory, used against Palestinians. Actually, a few Facebook pages were encouraging the murder of Palestinians to make them pay a price for the disappearance of the three Israeli settlers. Myself and many other people tried contacting Facebook in the U.S. to ask them to bring the page down. They said it's not in violation of our terms and conditions. But unfortunately, a few days after that, the Palestinian kid was abducted in an act of revenge. to what Israelis perceive to be an abduction by Palestinians. Now we know that that abduction actually had nothing to do with Hamas, because the Israeli police spokesperson told the BBC last week that we know that Hamas had nothing to do with that. And we knew that the kids were dead from day one. And we didn't, like, this information was not shared with the public. But of course, when the truth becomes public, who cares? Right? Because no one even asks about something that happened 3 weeks ago. They've already started a new campaign of bombardment and invasion of Gaza. I mean, I think this, the last escalation, is one of these few occasions where you can point to who started. You know, like, there's usually this confusion of who hit me first, you know, in the, or at least in the U.S. media. This one was crystal clear. There was a ceasefire that all Palestinian groups and Israel have been, you know, respecting for a while. Then Israel brings up this story about the three settlers who get abducted, and then they attack Gaza, and then the escalation starts, and then the ground invasion happens. So, I mean, you can actually point to who started the recent escalation easily. There are two different narratives about what happened and what is happening now. One of them is promoted by mostly the Israeli and American governments, and one of the other is promoted by almost everyone else in the world. It's amazing, like when I read Arabic news or even news in English, or I speak some Persian because my wife is from Iran, so news in Persian. No one says the things that are said in the US and Israel. No one portrays the conflict as a conflict between Israel and Hamas. What does that mean? Why can we portray a conflict to be a conflict between a country and a political party? Like, is it? I mean, it makes sense maybe to say it's a conflict between the Likud party and Hamas. I would maybe buy that because they are like the largest political parties. But to say it's a conflict between, to reduce the Palestinian people to one political party, It's not like a lack of understanding. This is a part of a strong agenda that denies Palestinians from their identity. People who think saying the word Palestinian is a concession. And therefore they will say Hamas, they will say terrorists, they will even say a word like Gazan, as if Gaza is a country, rather than saying Palestinian. And I don't hear that in any other languages, in any other countries around the world, except for the United States and from the Israeli media. The portrayal of the conflict that we hear it here is that Israel is a country that has the right to defend itself. I don't have to repeat it, because you've heard it a million times over the media. I don't think there are any attempts to dig deeper and see why this conflict exists, or explore the realities of the Israeli occupation of Palestinians. So the narratives are really painful, you know, like to see the difference between things that happen on the ground, and then, like when I was in Jerusalem and sirens kept on going off, and rockets, you know, were fired from Gaza towards Israel. I felt like I was in the middle of it, you know, like talking to people on like what they felt and how they've portrayed the conflict. But here in the U.S., we're so far removed, and there is an answer to anything that happens in the news to justify Israeli policies. Kids are being killed in the streets. Oh, Palestinians are using their own kids as human shields. No, although, I mean, number one, it's such a ridiculous claim. It's laughable. And it's racist to think that there are some people out there who will be willingly putting their kids, you know, the loves of their lives. I have a 1.5-year-old kid now. I will never put my kid, in danger, you know? And all of us are like this. All of us, when we have this, you know, parent, instinct to protect our kids. And you know, in the Palestinian society and in the Middle East, kids are kind of communal, you know? Like, every kid is everyone's kid. You know, like you see kids playing in the streets, if someone does something wrong, any adult will yell at them. If someone does something good, any adult will reward them. You know, it's like, there is no way Palestinians will sacrifice their own children. I mean, just how ignorance of an audience are we expecting to spread this message? But actually, it goes, you know, and so with some people, they buy it. So the problem is, there isn't anything that will happen that will be blamed on a wrong Israeli policy in the U.S. media. Whatever Israel does, you know, it's not theoretical. If Israel goes to Gaza and slaughters 1,500 civilians, with the entire world condemning it, the United Nations, Human Rights Watch, Amnesty International, every single country almost in the U.S. General Council, the General Assembly condemning it, we still hear justifications for it. So I feel like it's a lost cause to try to get information about what's going on in Israel and Palestine through U.S. media or through the U.S. Congress. And this would be the last thing I want to say about Israel and Palestine. Last week, there was a public opinion poll that showed that actually a majority of Americans between the ages of 18 and 29, an overwhelming majority of Americans, do not think that the Israeli attack on Gaza is justified. This has never happened before. 25% of Americans between 18 and 29 think it's justified, as opposed to 51% who think it's not justified. So 2-1. This has never happened before. And no thanks to the mainstream media. It's all because of the non-stop feed of Facebook and Twitter and other social media that circumvents the mainstream media's coverage. And I think these are the ages of people who are, you know, more exposed to this. Now, even the general public in the U.S., there is a bias towards supporting Israel. It's in the 50s, you know, 57% overall support Israel. When the Congress votes on anything that has to do with Israel and Palestine, it's almost 100% at every single occasion. Last week, the Congress failed to pass supplemental funding for the border because there are kids who need to be funded who were sent without their parents. They failed to put that. Democrats actually tried to pressure Republicans. You know, they play some political games. So they tried to pressure Republicans into voting yes on the supplemental by attaching a small fund for Israel in the supplement. So because they know saying no to funding Israel is like a crime that no one will commit, right? So what Republicans did is that they put a standalone piece of funding for Israel for the $225 million for the Israeli military, in addition to the $3.1 billion that we give them every year. And both parties voted on that. The Senate passed it unanimously. So no one said no, out of 100 senators that we have. And in the House, out of 435 Congress members, 8 said no. So less than 2%. So the numbers don't correspond. You know, like sometimes people think that there is an overwhelming majority of Americans who support Israel blindly. It's actually not true. There is an overwhelming majority of Congress members who support the U.S. blindly, but they don't really represent the U.S. public opinion. Let me speak a little bit about the situation in Iraq, which is, you know, it's related to what's going on in Israel and Palestine as well, because the destruction of Iraq happened with the blessing and in many cases with the support of the Israeli government. Iraq, before 2003, as a country, posed some danger to Israel and the United States when it comes to their regional plans. So it was a regional player. The fact that Iraq was destroyed in 2003 and what we're living now through the implications, this has an effect on Israel and the United States as well. Let me start from what's going on in the last 2 hours and then go back to the larger picture. When we were driving to the event, there was news on the New York Times that the U.S. has bombed Iraq again. And I didn't believe it because I thought it's a rumor, because I don't think there is enough appetite in D.C. to engage militarily in Iraq again. Thankfully, the Pentagon just put a statement now denying that they have bombed Iraq. But now, this comes after a few hours of President Obama announcing that he's weighing in some options for what to do in Iraq. Because in the last few weeks, this new terrorist organization called the Islamic State, flavor of the month terrorist organization, we've never heard of them before, and now they became the strongest, the biggest threat to nations in the Middle East and Europe and the U.S. You know, a couple of years ago, it was another organization, and a couple of years before that, it was another one as well. There is always this, you know, this crazy organization that shows up out of nowhere, that gets a lot of attention, and it's good for marketing some sort of a U.S. Intervention. So according to the story that went viral today, this new crazy organization has attacked civilians in Iraq. And these civilians, who happen to be from minorities, Iraqi minority, like religious and ethnic minorities, they run away to the top of a mountain. And so Obama was thinking in the morning, what to do to these civilians who run away to the top of a mountain? Should he drop food and water to the civilians on top of the mountain, or should he bomb the bad guys on bottom of the mountain? Now, I mean, for me, this sounds like a caricature. It sounds like a joke. Why would that happen? Like, why would people run? It just doesn't add up. Why would people run away without food? Why wouldn't they go to another city? Why would they go to the top of a mountain? Why would the bad guys wait for them downstairs instead of coming up and slaughtering them if they're that bad? I don't get it. Like, I don't get the dynamic. More importantly, what is the U.S.? Is the U.S. a charity organization that drops food on hungry people on top of mountains? We kill people! 1,500 people were just killed in Gaza with our weapons. 1 million Iraqis were killed in the last decade by our tax dollars, by our army mostly. We're going to save a couple hundred people hungry on top of a mountain. Who makes up these stories? It infuriates me, you know? Because, like, the assumptions behind it is that we are this force of good that, you know, we can't go to sleep while there is a baby hungry on top of a mountain 10,000 miles away from us. That's not who we are! We have the most violent foreign policy in the world. We're bombing people's countries non-stop, killing civilians right and left. I mean, I don't get where this moral authority comes from, you know? So what's going on in Iraq in the last few weeks is that there is another deterioration. And You know why Iraqis are not surprised that there is another deterioration? Because Iraqis don't have a functional government. Iraq has the worst government in the region, the fourth most corrupt government in the world, according to Transparency International, the worst life quality in the world is in Baghdad, the most violent conflicts that have been happening in the region are in Iraq. Why do the Iraqis have this? Iraq wasn't hit by a tsunami or an earthquake. It was occupied by a brutal military occupation that turned it from the most developed country in the Middle East to the least developed country in the world, almost. Now, I'm not surprised that there is an ISIS today and Al-Qaeda yesterday and some other crazy group in the south called Asaib Ahl al-Haq the day before and another crazy group next month. That's not surprising. And that's why many people in this room said no to the invasion in 2003. not because people were sentimental, because people thought invasions destroy countries. And this is what we're living now, is not a failed invasion or a result of an invasion that went wrong. No, this is how countries look after we destroy them with a brutal military occupation. And the Iraqis will need decades to fix what the US has done. Now, do Iraqis need extra bombs to fall on their heads from the US? Definitely not. Do they need food and water to be dropped on a mountain? Definitely not. There are so many people in Iraq who need to be rescued, and there are so many problems in Iraq. I don't think the US has any moral or political authority to deal with them. Just to give you an example. You've heard in the last couple of weeks about a displacement crisis in Iraq, right? Christians were kicked out of Mosul. Few other minorities were kicked out of other places in Iraq. The years following the U.S. invasion of Iraq, there were 5 million Iraqis who were displaced, mostly between 2005 and 2007. And these people were not displaced randomly. They were displaced because of a very brutal political agenda that was meant to divide the country according to what we call now the Biden plan, creating a Shiite state in the south, a Sunni state in the middle, and a Kurdish state in the north. The main obstacle in the way of that plan and agenda was having 4 million Iraqis who were in the wrong region. There were a couple of million Sunnis living in the south, a couple of million Shiites living in the center. So, while the U.S. is occupying Iraq, there was a systemic campaign to displace 5 million Iraqis out of the population of 30 million. I don't remember hearing a single bit of news about them. I don't remember the U.S. crying over millions of Iraqis being displaced under the U.S. occupation. But now we hear about 1,000 families who are being displaced because of the latest crazy terrorist organization here. How many families are being hurt there? So these families are being hurt. And I think all Iraqis continue to have pain for every single family that is being displaced or injured or killed in the last 10 years. But these are all a part of the same phenomenon. Whether they were displaced in 2005 or 2014, they are paying a price for an illegal and immoral occupation that has destroyed their country. There are many ways to fix it, and these ways do not include U.S. military intervention. And I think that should be crystal clear for all of us. Okay, now you're stuck here because it's raining. I don't feel bad for you anymore. let me tell you about the Obama administration's policy, and with that I will end and open the floor to your feedback and questions. So in Iraq, we have a central government that is extremely corrupt, extremely sectarian, extremely dysfunctional. It gets around $120 billion a year of oil sales. Oil sales constitute anywhere between 95 and 98% of Iraq's income. And what the entire country does is 2%. So 98%, they're just sitting there while oil is being pumped. And 2% is every other effort that this government is doing. Nothing. It's negligible. Whether the government existed or not, Iraq's GDP will not change. It's true. It's pathetic. Imagine, like, there is nothing. There is no economy other than pumping oil. And Iraq's economy, Iraq's oil sales every year, is more than the budgets, the GDPs of Jordan, Syria, Lebanon, and Egypt combined. So these countries have over five times the population of Iraq. Egypt alone, for God's sake, has 88 million people in it. These four countries combined have a budget smaller than Iraq. The Iraqis don't have electricity. They don't have decent streets that they can drive on. The government has spent trillions of dollars on nothing, on corruption, money that is ending up in bank accounts in Switzerland. And buying expensive cars in Europe and in Washington, D.C. So this government has a human rights record that is as bad or worse than the Saddam Hussein government. We heard about Saddam Hussein all the time. All the time. It was the number one news. Saddam today killed a baby. Saddam ate a baby. Saddam torture the baby. So, you know, like every day in the news, these exaggerations of what was going on in Iraq, or actually bringing up stories of real abuses that were happening in the country and abusing these stories for, you know, like to push for the U.S. agenda there. I lived in Iraq during the 90s, and Iraq had huge restraints on freedom of speech. People could speak about some political issues, but there were a big price to pay if you criticized the president. At the same time, it was a functional country. We had free healthcare, free education, you know, like the basic human needs were provided to people. And there were some attempts to maybe fix or improve the system from within. At that time, the U.S. media only saw the most horrible cases of abuses in Iraq. Now, Iraqi forces are engaged in torture. There are videos online that shows Iraqi soldiers taking videos and uploading themselves to YouTube because they feel proud of it. They have this practice of stopping people at checkpoints, cutting their backs with blades, and putting salt on it, which is a torture method from the Dark Ages. They think it's funny. They think it's legitimate. There are extrajudicial killings on checkpoints that are uploaded on YouTube. They stop someone on a checkpoint and ask him, "Why did you try to come through the checkpoint? Tell us why." He doesn't answer. They shoot him in front of a camera. There are thousands of abuses documented by Human Rights Watch of mass executions of Iraqi prisoners in one room. They put them in one room, shoot them all. Torture, executions. The record is disturbing. Human Rights Watch says that the Iraqi government has been indiscriminately bombing civilian neighborhoods, killing civilians just right and left. War crimes. They're committing war crimes. What does the Obama administration decide to do in the situation in Iraq? they decide to support the Iraqi government. So they send advisors to Iraq to support the Iraqi government. We're sending them more weapons. We have $150 million of annual training to their forces. Other billions of dollars of assistance and military assistance. What's the rationale? Oh, because these are a legitimate central government who's fighting an armed uprising in Iraq. Okay, let's keep it there for a second. Let's look at Syria. Syria has a legitimate central government, kind of, and it's fighting a group of armed militias who are leading an uprising, who happen to be the same groups in Iraq, whether it's the Islamic State or whether it's other groups. The Obama administration in Syria supports the opposition groups by sending them money and weapons. So I asked, actually, in one of the meetings at the White House, I said, how come there is this apparent contradiction? And I was told, because in Syria, there are very extreme groups, and we try to support the moderate opposition groups to weaken the extreme groups. Okay. Well, makes a little bit of sense. Now, put the two pictures together. Here's the joke about the Obama administration's policy in the Middle East. These two countries are not two islands, in the ocean. These are two countries that are adjunct to each other. And the Obama administration is funding the opposite sides of the same conflict on the opposite sides of the border. So in Iraq, where there is the Islamic State, and there are many moderate opposition groups holding guns against the Iraqi government, who are linked completely to the Obama administration's friends who are getting $500 million from our tax money, they're being bombed by the Obama administration's money and weapons in Iraq. If they are in Iraq, but if they cross to Syria, which they do all the time, they receive our money. And the Iraqi central government that we support with our money and funds and legitimacy is the number one ally of the Syrian regime. So when the Iraqi government has, when they feel like there is a lot of attacks going on against their forces in Mosul, they contact the Syrian government. And the Syrian government sends a jet fighter from Damascus, bombs Iraqi targets in Mosul to support the Iraqi central government. Now, how messy is this? Just think about it. This actually happens. We sent advisors to the Iraqi government to help them identify targets, what they call terrorist targets in the north of Iraq. But we don't have airplanes there to bomb them. So an American soldier sitting in Baghdad will tell his Iraqi counterpart, this is a target, this building is a target that you should bomb in Mosul. And the Iraqi government calls someone in the Syrian government, gives them the coordinates of this building, and then a Syrian, Russian Sukhoi flies from Damascus, bombs the target that was identified by the Obama administration. Isn't that the most crazy foreign policy you've heard of in your entire life? It is. And the craziest thing about it is that the White House has no clue that this is a crazy policy. They have no clue. Because their motto with what's going on is fire, then aim. That's exactly their motto. Fire, and then aim. Send weapons first, and then think who's our, how to justify it in Iraq and Syria. AFSC has been engaged in very strong discussions with the White House and State Department to tell them, there is no way you can justify requesting $500 million in the same week. One of these $500 million will go to support the Iraqi government, and the other $500 million will go support the Syrian opposition. This is a failed policy. You have no idea what you're doing, and therefore, you have to stop, take a few steps back, take a deep breath, and don't interfere in Iraq and Syria. And I hope they will hear this message over and over from you. because they can't fake it. You know, they can make some argument about why they are supporting the moderate opposition groups in Syria. They can make some argument why they're supporting the Iraqi central government, but they can make no arguments to reconcile these two opposing policies in two neighboring countries. And I think it's one of the strongest examples of contradictions for the Obama administration's policy in the Middle East. So, in short, I think there is one common thread to what I was saying, which is the U.S. role in the Middle East. The U.S. is not a bystander. You know, we're not like standing, watching things happening and feeling some sympathy to people on a mountain or kids who are being slaughtered in Gaza in a school of the United Nations or people in Syria who are being killed. This is, we're involved players with our tax money, with our intelligence intervention, with our military intervention. Israel received 55% of all U.S. military assistance around the world, $3.1 billion. This year it will be higher because of the extra funds that we've been sending. And there are U.S. Obligations that prohibits the U.S. government from funding and sending assistance to foreign governments who are abusing human rights. Foreign security forces who are committing gross human rights abuses. We have U.S. domestic law that prohibits us from doing that. Whether it's the Leahy law, which I will expand on during the question and answer, so one of you have to ask me this. Whether it's the Arms Export Act, whether it's other obligations that we have under U.S. laws, or obligations that we have under international humanitarian law, we can't send weapons to Israel while Israel is bombing children in Gaza. We can't send weapons to the Iraqi government while they're engaged in ethnic cleansing and torture. We can't send weapons to armed opposition groups in Syria. We have no idea who they are or where the weapons will end up with. So, but what we can do is, number one, follow a no-harm policy. Number one, we have to stop supplying weapons to Middle Eastern dictators and countries that are committing gross violations of human rights. There are many other things that we can do proactively, build peace and bring Israelis and Palestinians to a conference and let them hug, bring their babies and play together. You know, we have a million projects that we can work on. But number one is stopping our current policies of destruction, which is supporting violence and funding violence and arming violence. Let me stop here and let's take some of your thoughts and ideas.